Hello, I'm Fred Stella, President of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. A few months ago, I attended an event sponsored by our parent organization, the Kauffman Institute. I was told that the subject of the evening was somewhat of a local hero in the faith community with a significant following. I was amazed to find out that there was hardly a free seat in the house when I showed up. Yeah, it seems that Nicholas Woltersdorf is somewhat of a legend in certain circles. The format of the evening was somewhat of an interview of Dr. Woltersdorf conducted by my colleague, Kelly Clark. It was suggested that I get Nicholas in here in the studio and interview him myself, but honestly, I could not have done anywhere near as good a job as Dr. Clark, who incidentally has been somewhat of a mentee of Nicholas over the years. So this week and next, we'll hear a deeply personal and open discussion between two men who have helped mold the religious landscape of West Michigan. A little bit about Nicholas Woltersdorf. He was a professor of philosophical theology and taught at Yale since 1989 and then retired in 2002. Previously, he taught at Calvin College, the Free University of Amsterdam, and the University of Notre Dame, and has been a visiting professor at several institutions. He is past president of the American Philosophical Association and served on its publication and executive committees. He's on the editorial boards of Faith and Philosophy, Topics in Philosophy, and is also general editor of the Supplementary Textbook Project of the Christian College Coalition. In addition to numerous articles, he has written and co-written many books, including but not limited to Religion in the Schools, On Universals, Reason Within the Bounds of Religion, Art in Action, Works and Worlds of Art, Education for Responsible Action, Until Justice and Peace Embrace, Faith and Rationality, Lament for a Son, and Keeping Faith, Talks for a New Faculty. Now, let's listen to part one of an evening with Nicholas Woltersdorf.
When I was growing up, I was taught, not by telling, but by just modeling, the importance of hard work, stick-to-itiveness, not complaining, accepting what's given you. That sort of fits with a point that Steve was making about what befell me. Secondly, by the grace of God, I was given opportunities that fitted my talents. I said I was going to make 2 points. I'll make three or four. Third, the training that my community gave me, the family, but the community as a whole. You have to visualize, some of you have told me that when you've read the book, it reminded you of small villages in the Midwest and so forth, in which you too have grown up. They were genuine communities of shared concern. It was not just parents and children, but the adults minded, tended each other's children. So as I say in the book, we as children soon learned who was nice and who was bossy. And we tried to avoid the bossy people, of course. But I think the other thing to add, Kelly, is that I was fortunate to grow up at a time in this country which was, for white males like me, a time of extraordinary privilege. I say for white males like me, it was not for women, it was not for colored people, for white males like me. And until my 20s, I suppose, I simply accepted that as fact of life. I then soon began to see the injustice of it. We'll get to some of the injustices later on. But I was privileged to live in a time after the Second World War, when American colleges and universities were expanding, when jobs for academic people like me were opening up. When I got a PhD from Harvard, I didn't know of any colleague who was also getting a PhD who did not also almost immediately get a job. In my last 10, 15 years of teaching at Yale, I had to console students who got no job for 4 years and then got one-year jobs for 6 years. And I have no idea how psychologically they managed it. I'm not sure that I could have managed it. So I lived through a golden age. I, as a white male, lived through a golden age in the history in general of America, the political history, and the educational history. So that's one way of answering how from that tiny little village to here.
So we're really making a lot of progress here. We're already through childhood. This is something he wrote about college. Nick went to Calvin College, and he said this about it. College proved to be for me a journey into self-understanding. Here in this college of the religious tradition in which I had been reared, Reformed Protestantism, I began to understand the tradition, and thus myself, by watching it at work in some remarkably gifted and dedicated teachers. I learned how to live with integrity within the tradition, within any tradition, how to discern and embrace its fundamental contours while treating its details as matters of indifference, how to appropriate what in the tradition is capable of nourishing life in one's own day while leaving the rest behind, how to criticize the tradition from within, expand its scope, celebrate its accomplishments, empathize with its anxieties and its memories of suffering. I think of a passage from the Night section of part one of Goethe's Faust. What you have as heritage, take now as task, for thus you will make it your own. So, and he writes about this a lot in here, and I'd like you to discuss this. So what did you acquire as heritage? And maybe you can talk about your favorite teachers that you talk about in here, Henry Staub and Harry Jellema. And then what did you take as task from this tradition? Yeah. And then how have you made the tradition your own?
So before I answer the question, I do want to get to that question. For me, entering Calvin College was indeed gaining insight into the deep levels of the tradition which I had been reared. But it was not only that. It was also, I remember, exhilaration. And I'm not sure how many high school kids going to college nowadays find it exhilarating. It was exhilarating. It was the sense of entering a bright and shiny new world. I'd had good teachers in high school, but it was enrapturing and intimidating. In the book, I tell the story about my freshman English class taught by another master teacher, Henry Zylstra. And I remember vividly that on the first day of class, Zylstra used three words that I had never heard in Southwest Minnesota. To this day, I remember one of them, chivalrous. Nobody in Southwest Minnesota had ever, to the best of my knowledge, used the word chivalrous. So I copied these words down and ran home and bought a dictionary from the bookstore and wrote out the definitions. And then the next day, next class, he used three more words that I'd never heard. So it was this sense of exhilaration. And as I say, when I look at my own grandchildren, well, they haven't entering college. When I listen to contemporary students talk, I'm not sure how many of them, upon entering college, university, have a sense of the exhilaration, and that's a great loss. College should be not just pouring facts and so forth into you, training you and so forth for a job in the economy, but it should be exhilarating. You should say, my gosh, I've never seen it that way before. How wonderful, how wonderful. Okay, so the tradition in which I'd been reared was Dutch Reformed Protestantism on the prairies of immigrant Dutch on the prairies of Southwest Minnesota. Now the story about the Reformed tradition, the Reformed Calvinist tradition, the standard story about it is that it's all about election. I've learned recently that idea comes out of the 19th century, actually, when German philosophers in the Hegelian tradition wanted to find the essence of one thing and another. And the essence of Calvinism then was election, the essence of Lutheranism was grace, and so forth. I don't recall ever hearing sermons about election. That was not. When I think back to the tradition as I experienced it, it was devout, it was biblically oriented in church and family, but it was also living joyfully, enjoying the world. In the book, I tell the story of my father, simple little story. He was, in essence, his very nature was that he was a woodworker. That's just who he was. And I can still see he'd collect different species of hardwoods. He didn't like softwood like pine and fir and so forth, hardwood. He'd collect different species, rough boards, unplaned. He'd rub his hands over them and say, Nick, this is going to make something really beautiful and lovely. So I was taught reverence for wood, reverence for the earth. I remember my uncle, for whom I worked, Uncle Chuck, just glorying in improving the soil on his farm and how well the crops were doing this year. It was taking delight in our earthly existence, but also acting lovingly and responsibly to each other. The community, the extended family in which I grew up was they were argumentative. I talk about the arguments in the book. But in the midst of all the arguments, they were loving. They'd help each other out. I shall not forget Uncle Chuck and Aunt Clara getting into a vigorous dispute in one of these arguments, and at the end of it, standing up when it was time to go, kissing each other, hugging each other, and off they'd go. So it was thinking back, I experienced, this maybe sounds crazy to some people, but there in our living room, and we moved when we were 12 years old, Henriette and I, to Edgerton, a much bigger village of 1,000 people instead of 200. In our living room there, the most wonderful intellectual conversations, discussions in which everybody participated, women as well as men, young kids as soon as they wanted to participate. So what stood me in, you asked how I got from there to here. One thing that happened was I learned in those family discussions about everything under the sun. You have to go back 70 years, Harold Stass and Hubert Humphrey, the dams on the that were being built on the Missouri, what they would do to the local Native Americans, the pesticides that were, all of this. I learned to separate the person from the argument. You could disagree with somebody, even disagree vigorously, politely, but you were not attacking the person. And as you know as well as I, and Steve knows, essential to philosophy, and indeed to the academic enterprise in general, is that you have to distinguish the person from the argument. The fact that you're disagreeing should not be understood as an attack. Well, sometimes it is an attack, but it should not be an attack. So the tradition is I absorbed it, acted lovingly towards each other, took joy in material things, took joy in conversation. So it was, I suppose, in a word, it was life-affirming. That's how I experienced the tradition, life-affirming.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to an interview with Dr. Nicholas Wolterstorff, recorded in 2019 on the campus of Grand Valley State University. I'm Fred Stella. The interviewer is Kelly Clark, and this is WGVU-FM.
So you left Calvin and you went to graduate school, PhD program at Harvard. Those were the glory days of the Harvard Philosophy Department. Willard Van Orman Quine, Carl Hempel, C.I. Lewis, Nelson Goodman, and D.C. Williams were all on the faculty, to name just five of the most prominent figures. There was a lot of buzz about so-called logical positivism, a movement I had not heard about at Calvin. One of the claims of the positivists was that sentences that purport to be about God are in fact meaningless, not false, but meaningless. It wasn't long before I discerned that this claim was not a drinking in of objective facts about meaning, but it was instead an implication of the positivist worldview. I don't want to ask you to explain positivism, Nick, but you went from a Christian undergraduate institution where everybody held roughly your views and shared roughly the same worldview to a PhD program at Harvard, which was anti-theistic. That's the point I wanted to make from there. Anti-religious and probably even more so anti-Christian. They probably especially didn't like Christianity.
Yeah.
So two questions occur to me. How as a young man were you able to resist these anti-religious sentiments and the influence of your brilliant and prestigious philosophers? And second, how did you take what you learned at Harvard as heritage and task?
Yeah, so to answer your first question, Kelly, I've got to go back to a question you asked about my college education, my teachers, philosophy as I experienced it, and so forth. So let me say a word about that. As I say in the book, I didn't choose philosophy. Philosophy chose me. I shall never forget, in those days, I think still today, there is a required philosophy course. I took it in the first semester of my sophomore year, taught by a terrific teacher, Henry Staub. We are halfway into the first session, and I think, this is it. I have no idea whether I'll be any good at this stuff, but if I am, this is it. So people have asked me, you may have asked me, well, what did Staub say in that first half hour? I have no memory of what he said in that first half hour. I just know that it was magical. So how is philosophy taught? Well, for one thing, and this was a contrast to Harvard, we'll get to that. At Calvin, we studied philosophy. When I got to Harvard, everybody talked about doing philosophy. We studied philosophy, the philosophers of the past. Now, one way of studying philosophy, which some of you may have experienced, is that the teacher introduces you to the so-called problems of philosophy, the problems of theory of knowledge, the problems of theory of art, and so forth. That is not how my teachers at Calvin taught philosophy, Jalama Staub. They taught it as a succession of worldviews, deep and profound attitudes about God, reality, what's worthwhile, the world are coming to expression in philosophy. And you don't just want to plow through a bunch of problems, but you want to find out what view of reality, what worldview, world and life view was shaping the ancient Greek philosophers. You want to get to the problems after that, because I mean they expressed their worldview in the form of convictions and so forth. So I've always thought that what is more or less the standard way of doing, ever since my college days, I thought that the sort of standard way of doing philosophy, problems, misses out on what's really important about philosophy. In philosophy, I venture to say, as in no other academic discipline, the worldviews of human beings are being worked out in various areas of life. And that's what I learned from my Calvin professors. And a second thing I learned from them, Kelly, is that there was no index of forbidden books. We could read anything. There was never a suggestion that, oh, you're a Christian, so you should stay away from Nietzsche, for example. If you wanted to read Nietzsche, read Nietzsche. And a third very important thing, we Protestants, some of us Protestants, often think of the church as really beginning with Charles and John Wesley in the 1800s. And everything before that is, well, I don't know. That's Catholic stuff, you know. My teachers, Harry Jellema, Henry Staub, said, no. The medieval philosophers are your Christian heritage. You stand in that line. Don't forget it. So the whole sweep of philosophy was for us to discuss and talk about and so forth. So now I get to Harvard. So I've got this view imbued in me that philosophy is, at bottom, the working out of worldviews, fundamental worldviews. And I find, well, two things at Harvard. They have little interest in the history of philosophy. I'd been trained in the history of philosophy, but the Harvard philosophers of the time had little interest in the history of philosophy. It was all about doing philosophy. And to do philosophy, you've got to be current with what's going on. So I had even though I'd been very well trained in the history of philosophy at Calvin, I had a steep learning curve to find out what was going on in 1950, in the 40s and the 50s. And what was going on, especially in those days, as you say, was positivism. The idea that statements about God, reality in general, have no meaning. You can't verify them by standard scientific techniques. So they have no meaning. And this was a really hot topic in those days. I mean, it really was. It sounds musty to most people nowadays, really musty. But I didn't find my faith threatened because I said to myself, well, I'm very doubtful that these positivists are just sort of drinking in the objective meaning of meaning. There's a worldview at work here, and the worldview was pretty clear. It was the positivist's conviction that natural science was the road forward. All other modes of inquiry were just dead ends. So if you think that, then you got to tell me how natural science and its way of talking and thinking and so forth differs from all the other stuff, the bad stuff. So it was that worldview that was shaping what they were doing, that natural science is the road forward. I didn't believe it for a minute. And I mean, really, that natural science is the road forward for humanity? I found this totally implausible. And I saw that it was that worldview that was shaping the enterprise. So I viewed it with, a sort of bemused detachment. And I had a professor, D.C. Williams, my mentor actually, whose attitude was the same. D.C. was a classical metaphysician. His attitude about positivism was, oh, this too shall pass, as it did in 5 years or so. Now, the Christian part of it, Kelly, so my professors at Harvard, my fellow students, knew that I was a Christian. None of them ever berated me or belittled me on that account. And I don't know what was going on. I think I sometimes speculate that probably what was going on in their minds was, this Walter Storr fellow, he comes from the Midwest, he's religious. but he seems quite bright. He'll probably get over it. So, I mean, they never quite said that, but that fits what they did say. That's the answer to your question. I never felt my faith challenged. It was rather, I and others have to figure out a way of showing the silliness of the positivist enterprise, which then, within 5 years, succeeded and positivism collapsed. I'm giving answers that are too long for your short questions.
So in the fall of 1963...
Is the sound still okay?
You were teaching at Calvin, and you said, Alvin Plantinga had joined our department. Al had left Yale when I did and taught for a few years at Wayne State, University of Detroit. He was as committed as I was to the project of Christian philosophy and to practicing philosophy, not just studying philosophy. So this goes by quickly, but here's two young philosophers fresh out of graduate school, Plantinga and Walterstorff, and that would become like a term of art, Plantinga and Walterstorff. They were on the verge of becoming two of the greatest Christian philosophers of the 20th century. So what was your relationship like with Alvin, and how did that shape you and him going forward?
Yeah, well, I don't want to say much about how it shaped him, but so...
He's not here. He could have been.
Yeah, he could have been, yeah. Well...
He had his chance.
But he had a good reason for not being here, attending a memorial service for a friend of his. So Al spent his first year, I think just 1 year at Harvard, and then Al's father was teaching psychology at Calvin at the time. So when Al came back home for a spring vacation, he listened to some of Harry Jellema's lectures, and he found Jellema's lectures far more enrapturing than anything that he'd been hearing at Harvard. So he transferred, left Harvard for Calvin, and so we met in my junior year and became instant friends and philosophical colleagues and have remained that ever since. Eventually, I think, Kelly, what happened was that without making any big decisions on the matter, we sort of parceled out some of the territory without actually making a decision. Al would concentrate on philosophy of religion, and especially would answer in all kinds of ways, would deal in all kinds of ways with the widespread charge that religious people are somehow irrational. A colleague of mine at Yale put it like this: religious people suffer from a rationality deficit. Al would deal with that, and Al has dealt with that in varied ways over the years with great intellectual imagination, acuity, and so forth. And I would proceed on...
Everything else?
On the assumption that, you know, I'm not going to argue that case. I'm just going to take it that it's perfectly reputable for me to be a Christian and to be a Christian philosopher. And then I would deal with things to say in more specific areas of philosophy, like theory of knowledge and philosophy of art and justice and so forth. So over the years, we've had this sort of informal compact. Let me say one more thing. I taught for 2 years at Yale in 57 to 59. Parenthesis, let me explain how that happened, because this is an example of the injustice that I hinted at. I had gotten my degree from Harvard. Harvard gave me, in the spring of my third year at Harvard, my mentor, D.C. Williams, hands me a pamphlet on getting on the Sheldon Traveling Fellowships at Harvard. And D.C. says to me, you should apply for this. Walterstorff, he always addressed me as Walterstorff. So I looked at it and I said, but Professor Williams, this is designed for people who have to do research abroad, and everything that I need is available in Harvard Library and in Cambridge bookstores. And furthermore, I expect to have my dissertation finished this summer. He said, I know all that, it doesn't make any difference. So I applied and got this fellowship. Six of us. Classicist J.P. Elder is the chair of the Sheldon Traveling Fellowship. He has the six of us over for a sherry party. And he knows what's up, and he taps me on the shoulder. And these are his exact words: Walterstorff, you should use this money to sample European culture. And I instantly had the thought, well, who am I, a kid from the farm country of Minnesota to tell Harvard how they should and shouldn't spend their money. So we did that. So Claire and I are, we spent a term in Cambridge, England, then the spring in Amsterdam. And here's where we get to the injustice of it. Sitting in Amsterdam, and I get a letter from the head of the Yale Philosophy Department offering me a position in the Yale Philosophy Department. He didn't ask me to apply or anything like that. He just offered the job. Now, he was very courtly, Brand Blanchard. So I never dared ask him how this went, but I know how it went. He called up the chair of the Harvard Philosophy Department and said, "Do you have any recent graduates?" The chair of Harvard Department said, "Try Walterstorff." So women were, everybody outside this old boys network was excluded, right? That's the injustice of it. It was deeply unfair to everybody but me.
You've been listening to an interview with religious philosopher Nicholas Walterstorff, recorded here on the campus of Grand Valley State University. I'm Fred Stella. Please join us next week for part two. This is Common Threads on WGVU.